In the ED, we deal with a lot of horrible things. Child abuse, human trafficking, and domestic violence, to name a few. It's that last one that I wanted to focus on for this segment. I'm here with Jamie Hope to discuss this incredibly challenging scenario. I think we all know that domestic violence isn't infrequent, but Jamie, how common is it?
Every single minute, 24 people are the victims of rape or physical violence in the United States. So that counts for about 12 million people per year. One in three women and one in seven men have been the victims of severe physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
We often do talk about women having this issue, but this is an issue for men as well. We need to be open on both ends to asking about this and exploring it. Now, on occasion, a patient will present stating very plainly that they were assaulted by a partner, but let's be honest, that's not usually the way it happens. Are there specific injuries or injury patterns that should tip us off, similar to what we see in kids that tip us off to child abuse?
Yes. And so it's really important, first of all, to keep this on your radar, recognizing that men can be victims too, recognizing that this occurs in every zip code, every race, gender, religion, socioeconomic status. And then just like we look for injury patterns in children and the elderly, you're looking for specific pattern-type bruises, whip marks, cigarette burns, handprint bruises, and things like that. So those are kind of the more obvious type ones. But the less straightforward ones, think somebody who is coming in with maybe recurrent abdominal pain. And just like in kids, if the injury pattern doesn't fit the story, or if they're very uncomfortable making eye contact, or they don't have an explanation for their symptoms, all of those type of things are kind of a tip off that maybe something a little more might be going on, and he or she might be uncomfortable disclosing the information.
Back a couple months ago, Jenny Beck-Esme and I did an LLSA review of an article looking at human trafficking and pointed out many of the similar features of your examination or your history taking where eye contact isn't made. The partner never leaves the room or never leaves the side of the person. And those are also things that should tip you off that something else is going on. Obviously, if you find multiple injuries, especially if you're looking in your EMR and the patient presents multiple times for multiple different fractures, that should be something to start ringing bells that maybe something else is going on as well. And one of the ones that I think we hear about or we see is strangulation. We were discussing doing this segment before a little bit offline, and you hinted that strangulation has some specific implications with it as well.
Strangulation, very specifically, is a significant predictor for future lethal violence. If an abuser has strangled their victim, that victim's chance of death by violence is 10 times higher. So, Swami, I want people to look at this like a sentinel bleed and subarachnoid hemorrhage. This is your chance to intervene. This is your opportunity to recognize that this particular injury pattern has occurred and really do all of your best efforts to make sure that you help get this person connected to help. Because if they go back into that home, they are substantially more likely to die.
Yeah, tenfold higher risk of death in any other disease would be really setting off all the alarm bells and whistles for us. We would never let a patient with that kind of a risk just go home without having a structured approach to what we're going to do to resolve that situation. So I think that is a very important tip. And often we see patients who have had strangulation where there's no actual injury. There might be some marks on the neck, but there's no deeper injury that is alarming to us. But it is, like you said, a sentinel event for future severe violence.
So you mentioned in terms of the symptoms. So if there's obvious, very significant bruising around the neck, either from hands or some form of ligature, that's obvious. But I just wanted to share with everybody some of the softer signs of strangulation to keep it higher on their radar. So looking at somebody who is complaining of sore throat, neck pain, hoarse voice, drooling, looking for bruising on the neck, but also behind the ears, because if they're being lifted at the same time as strangulation, often you're going to get a little bit of bruising there. You're going to look at the tongue for things like discoloration or injury, you know, certainly different than a seizure pattern. And then petechial hemorrhages on the face, the subconjunctival hemorrhage, and they might be complaining of dizziness and headache. With strangulation, you can cut off somebody's airway in a matter of minutes and lead to death. So sometimes they can have a head injury, loss of consciousness, or even a seizure from anoxic brain injury. And then the post effects are similar to a traumatic brain injury if it's severe enough. So keeping those different things as part of your physical exam on your radar are really going to help you recognize this key sentinel event.
Are there other situations that put a patient at a higher risk for abuse or violence escalation that we should be looking out for?
There are a couple of very specific times in a victim's life that they are going to be at increased risk. Anything with pregnancy, childbirth, and the postpartum period. So sometimes in pregnancy, the violent partner will try and induce miscarriage by punching them, pushing them down the stairs, and other form of violence. During childbirth and after in the postpartum period, there's much higher rates of violence. In the postpartum period, they're more likely to be subject to physical violence, and also it's a time of increased sexual violence. Now, in that immediate postpartum period, the reason that we recommend that victims don't engage in intercourse, that the cervix isn't closed, and it puts them at higher risk for air embolism, endometritis, and postpartum bleeding and tears. And then the other time that is most dangerous for a victim is when they try to leave the abuser. Abuse is all about control. So when a victim tries to be empowered and establish control over their life and leave for their safety, that often escalates the violence. And that is when the victim is most likely to be killed by their intimate partner.
Jamie, I think when we see these patients, when we recognize them, we have a lot of anger. Obviously, we're angry at the person who has subjected our patient to the violence, but sometimes our anger gets misdirected to the patient themselves. And one question that I hear more frequently than I'd like to is, why don't you just leave?
It's such an interesting thing that we end up asking the victim that instead of understanding the situation. So there are true reasons why the victim doesn't leave. If it were so simple, nobody would be in an abusive situation. But in a lot of cases, there's fear. As we mentioned, leaving leads to escalated violence. In some instances, patients believe that the abuse is normal. Perhaps they were raised in a similar environment and assume that that is how relationships are supposed to be. There is a lot of embarrassment and shame associated with being a victim, and so sometimes people are afraid to speak out. In different situations, the abuser might threaten them and say, if you leave me, I'm going to take the children, I'm going to kill the children. Can you imagine trying to walk away from a situation where someone says, okay, you're free, but I'm going to take and kill our children? Of course, it's going to be substantially harder for the victim to leave. And in many situations where they're with an intimate partner, they did love or do love that person and otherwise have a relationship. So it's more complicated than just walking away from a stranger who punches you in the face. Sometimes perpetrators hold on to the victim's money, driver's license, identity, passport, financial documents, and make it impossible for them to leave. And then the last group of victims that are at higher risk are people who have a disability. Perpetrators will sometimes withhold their assistive devices, their medications, their access to care, even if they need help to the bathroom and stuff like that during a time of illness. So there's a lot of reasons that somebody might not leave in that situation. So by coming at them with a very judgmental question and our misplaced anger, why don't you leave? It's really creating a barrier between the patient and seeking future care. So we really need to work to erase that line of thinking and understand that the situation is more complicated than you recognize. What we want to come at is a place of support, saying, how can I help you get out of the situation, instead of the blame and shame.
Jamie, let's bring this back to what we can do once we identify or have a high suspicion domestic violence is going on. What are the reporting laws that apply to emergency clinicians?
All 50 states mandate reporting of child abuse. And 47 states mandate reporting of elder abuse. But when it gets to the reporting of domestic violence in adult patients, it gets a little bit murkier. So most states have reporting of injuries due to firearms or deadly weapons. So if the intimate partner violence occurs with that, it's going to necessarily need to be reported. And then states have provisions for things like, quote, severe injuries or injuries that result from a criminal act that necessitate reporting. So as I was going through all the state-specific reporting laws, I saw there is a substantial amount of variation. Anytime you're talking about reporting a competent adult patient to the police without their consent, there are some ethical questions. So they might avoid seeking future care, they have fear of retribution, and as we discussed, that's a time where they're at increased risk for violence or being killed. I found a very interesting article in the AMA Journal of Ethics, and I'm just going to read a quote from that. A review of the literature to date fails to isolate any substantial data to support the premise that mandatory reporting laws improve the situation for those it intends to protect. And so that's the difference. It's not that we don't care about these victims or want to help them. It's that component of mandatory reporting that could potentially put them at increased risk. So that would be, you know, a whole separate area of ethical discussion that we could dive into. So if anybody's interested, they can take a look at that article. We'll put it in the show notes. And then also, I'm going to provide a list for every one of the 50 states so people can go on and look at the specific laws in their state and be familiar with them.
So Jamie, what we've got here is a common issue, one that we're going to see in the emergency department all the time. What do we do then for the patient that we see in front of us? Aside from managing the medical issues that are going on, what else can we provide?
So if there were three things that I could ask that every emergency physician do when you are treating a victim of domestic violence, it would be these. So number one, you want to be a safe and non-judgmental place so they can get good medical care and not be afraid of the system. If they're not ready to leave the situation today, but you're able to provide good care, you're opening the door so they have the opportunity to come back in the future if they need it. So I think that's extremely important. Number two, keeping strangulation on your radar. Look for the obvious and the subtle signs of that because this is an extremely lethal act. 10 times the risk of death with just that one act. So keeping that on your radar. And then number three, know your local resources. Every community has places for victims of domestic violence to go, but there's a lot of variation. There's also a national domestic violence hotline that has a very comprehensive list of resources and ways for victims to get help. So that would be to be a safe, non-judgmental place, keep strangulation on your radar, and know your local resources. These are our patients to protect. And it is so common. 24 people every single minute. How long this podcast was, think of how many people were injured during the course of this. And as emergency medicine physicians, we are on the front line and we have the opportunity to make a substantial difference in these people's lives.
Jamie, I think this was really helpful to raise awareness of this issue, keep it on people's radar when they're working. And that point of being a non-judgmental, supportive space, even if the patient isn't ready for that leaving, even if the patient isn't ready to report this to the police, but just telling them, if you change your mind, if you decide that you do want to report, come back and we will be here to take care of you. I think those are very simple words that we can say, and we say it to patients every day, that we should really be offering to this group and tell them, we're a safe place. Come back if you change your mind, if you need help, if there's anything that you need from us. And that opens the door for them to revisit us and then take advantage of whatever resources we do have or what we can offer and get them out of that scenario. Jamie, thanks so much for doing this.
Swami, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it and the opportunity to talk about such an important topic. Thank you.